Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to the Four Persons Network. To learn more about what we do, go to our show page at thefourpersons.com and our blog site at thefourpersons.net. Tonight's show is The Tangled Web with Deb Rojas. With the help of our Mother Mary, we seek to untangle the knots we find and sometimes cause in our own lives. If you have a comment or question, drop it in the show chat room or call in at 515-602-9655. That number again is 515-602-9655. And now, let's welcome Deb Rojas.
Tangled Web. Are you hearing me okay? All right, excellent. we have your host, Deb Rojas, with us. I am Craig Foley, and tonight we have as our very special guest, Gian Ellis. How are you, Gian?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Gian is a therapist who works closely with Deb in the Philadelphia area. But as you heard, if you want to call in, please call in. It's 515-602-9655. Tonight we're going to talk about a number of things, but first of all, Easter. What's your favorite memory of Easter, Deb?
My favorite? I have to say, the Gloria was pretty fantastic this year. The church was completely dark, as in all of the lights were out. And when the Easter candle came in, the light of Christ was present. The exultet was still done by candlelight. So we were waiting very patiently for the Gloria, where all the lights could come on.
What's the exultet?
It's what the priest sings that just tells the story of creation. And how Christ is really the light of the world. So we're rejoicing. We're rejoicing that Easter's here.
Cool.
So Christ is, he's present with us. But what was really cool is we sang Secret Cherubus by candlelight. And I didn't screw it up.
Wow.
More memorized than I realized. And then when we got to the Gloria and Father did Gloria in excelsis Deo, there was this huge organ interlude. And as the altar was being lit, the organ just got bigger and bigger and bigger. I wish you guys could see my arms because it's just expanding the sound of the organ. So it was just really climactic, and then all of the lights went on, and at the same time all the bells are ringing, and it was just this incredibly joyful moment. And then we broke out into the Missa Pape Martelli mass setting, which is just an absolutely glorious polyphonic mass setting. And it was really, really special. Very joyful.
Well, sounds fantastic. We had a very beautiful service as well. As you know, I am critical of Novus Ordo, the new mass, which has been around since 72. Do you know? Something like that.
62, the council
was
the council. Yeah.
It wasn't the council, it was the new mass, which came in later.
Yeah.
And it's valid, I'm not saying that, but it's awfully plain, and it's more like a church service rather than the mass. But at times when you have a good man like we have, he tries to make it really reverent and to bring back some of the the things that lift the soul towards heaven, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Vigil Mass is a great example of that, when we had the candles and we chanted a lot of the, what do you call it again, Deb?
Exalted.
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 Oh, exalted. Okay.
And, exalted.
We're listening. But anyway, so yeah, that's we don't have the same facilities as you have. We are a simple country parish with a lot of retired people, but it was quite beautiful with the candles and everything. But the other thing was, we had a whole family coming to the church this Easter.
Wow.
From the mother, father's already in the church, but all the kids, you know, stair-step kids all the way down to a really small girl. And it was really beautiful to have them all be baptized. And then a little Chico was anointed with oil, and the rest of them were confirmed. So that was like a really, of course, a beautiful part too. But I have another question for you. What is your favorite memory from days gone by? When you were a kid or any time. What's your favorite Easter memory? Gian, you got anything?
Yeah, let's ask Gian that.
Just family. I mean, every Easter since I can remember, we've spent with my mom's side of the family. You know, for a while it was, you know, my maternal grandparents who hosted at their house in Trevose, outside of Philadelphia. That's where I'm from.
Cool.
The area outside of Philadelphia. So it was there for a number of years, and it was just full of life. It was vibrant. There's it was very, you know, just a lot of love, you know. And my grandma was kind of the fuel of that. You know, she was very caring and passionate, and she kind of organized everything and brought the whole family together.
I
would say, and it kind of centered around her. Of course, my grandfather was you know, very important and relevant, but he was kind of much quieter, a little less social.
But he enjoyed the food.
More shy. certainly, everyone enjoyed the food. So we've carried that tradition on. Both of those people have passed. But now my parents are hosting most years. Sometimes they're flipping between, you know, a different cousin and my parents. But my parents are hosting. Mm. So it's really nice to just be able to have people over at our house. It's not my house anymore, but it's the house I grew up in. So it's kind of like my house.
Yeah. Do you have any good food to eat?
We don't really have any like traditions or like signature dishes for Easter. So no, not really. No.
What about chocolate?
Chocolate. I mean, there's chocolate. Yeah, there's chocolate, but you know, yeah, it's, I wouldn't say it's always there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We like chocolate year-round, so we don't like to limit it to just the Easter chocolate.
However, after the fast, there's something about bringing out all the candy after the Lenten fast.
Mm.
The candy and the chocolate and the dessert that kind of make it more of a special celebration.
I think that's really important because, I don't know about you guys, when I was a kid, we had very few treats. You know, one thing, we were really poor, so there just wasn't money to have a whole lot of special stuff, like soda. You say soda?
Mm-mm. No,
what do
you got
say?
It. No, I was just, I didn't say anything. I was just thinking that we didn't even have soda, maybe once a week on Friday nights with pizza, but it was
right,
like.
Right, yeah. So now it's like everywhere and people have it every single day. And that's fine, whatever. But when we were kids, like once a month would have been more like it. I mean, we never had anything like that. So when it was a big holiday like Easter and we had all this candy, it was like, amazing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Holy cow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like, jelly beans, like, there's nothing really good to eat. I guess I'll eat a jelly bean. But when I was a kid, I mean, those jelly beans were like, oh, wow, they were just so amazing. But I think one of the great things for me about becoming a Catholic was that explosion of joy at Easter, you know,
mm-hmm.
because before there's very little difference. You know, you have chocolate as you go along, and then Easter, here's a bunch more chocolate. Ah, okay. And then the next day, back to normal. Instead of, we kind of get to create the real, one of the real joys of having a poor childhood. You know, the great thing about being really poor as you come up is that the treats are so treaty. You know, it's so, you know, it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to say, Dion?
I said that's a good point. Yeah, you appreciate and savor the treats.
Right. I guess that's probably not what the fathers of the church were thinking when they instituted Lent. we need to make Easter even more treaty for people. They're not enjoying it like they could.
But if you think about it, it's a time of year seasonally where there's less on which to feast in nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more of a barren time coming out of winter,
right,
through spring, you know. So it's, I always thought it was really awesome that the flowers started to bloom around Easter. It was like the earth was reminding everybody that the resurrection was expected.
Yeah.
Guaranteed, even. Guaranteed. It would happen.
Yeah. What are you going to say, Gia?
Well, I was just thinking you know what popped out of my head?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Don't matter. Something Deb said sparked me too, and now you've done it to me, Gianna. I can't remember what I was going to say either.
Wow, but it's contagious.
Let's make it happen to Deb.
Oh, you guys are safe.
So Deb, what's the idea? Can you give us a favorite childhood memory?
Well, you know what's funny?
Easter?
I don't really have any Easter childhood memories, except that there was one woman in my church growing up. So my dad was a Baptist pastor when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so people would naturally like give our family things for holidays. And she would make these chocolate covered peanut butter eggs in a massive foil pan with like the little green baked grass and peeps.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would be little jelly beans hidden in the grass too. But mm-hmm. she would, the peanut butter eggs were homemade. And so that was always, like, we looked forward to it. We called her Grandma Knox. We looked forward to her Easter eggs every year. And, I just always think of that with fondness. But I don't really have many Easter memories because Protestants look at every Sunday as Resurrection Sunday, and which it is, which we as Catholics also do. We have a mini Triduum every Friday, mm-hmm. Saturday, Sunday.
Right.
But we also have a major Triduum every year.
Right.
And so in which we more profoundly and solemnly remember and celebrate the passion, the burial, the death, and the resurrection of Christ. So it's kind of interesting.
It's a bit more of a big deal for Catholics.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
What, Easter or Sunday, Dion?
Easter. I was thinking the Easter, you know, the Easter Triduum, if you will, maybe capital T, as opposed to the one every
mm-hmm.
week, which is not to be discounted by any means.
Right.
You know, I don't think, I think it's sometimes it's a struggle for us to enter into that. You know, certainly the reminders there every Sunday of
mm-hmm.
the Paschal mystery and of the resurrection. You know, in particular.
And we have historical fasting on Fridays, every Friday, historically.
Historically.
Right.
Historically. Yeah, and I mean, that's something I picked up a few years ago, and I do that now. I fast every Friday, but it doesn't seem to be a common discipline in the church anymore. So there is kind of a lack of entry into that weekly Paschal mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I was kind of half joking, laughing about making Easter more treaty, but it really is like a fact of human nature, right? Because it's really good for us to go through Lent. And I think it's really good to go through the little Lent once a week. A little fast.
Right. When you, when you think about why Easter is more treaty, to use your made-up word,
more treaty.
You can chant that if you like. You know, it is more treaty because the whole season is more fasty.
Yeah, that's true. We need more fastiness in our lives, I think.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be like a misery, but it needs. it's really good for you to fast a little bit. I've heard some things recently about fasting being good for your body, but even if you can't bodily fast, to at least sort of aesthetically fast, you know, in some sense,
sure.
I think it's really good for you, good for your soul.
Yeah, I have a good friend who just stopped listening to music for all of Holy Week.
Wow.
Yeah, she
that's,
was like,
good.
"I'm just,
good.
I'm going to incorporate cool. silence," and so from Palm Sunday to the vigil, she didn't turn on music in her car or in her house and allowed that time to be more available to prayer and meditation.
That's
really awesome.
I was really impressed with her. Yeah.
Yeah. Is huge. Something I think about too, in terms of really entering into whether it's the, you know, the grand celebration of the Triduum, again, I'm going to use the capital T Triduum,
mm-hmm.
versus the lowercase t that is every single week, is
mm-hmm.
is that sense of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think mm-hmm. that we you know, are often in so many different directions. At least I know as a young adult, that's certainly the case for a lot of us. I think my parents have kind of settled into their parish. They have,
mm-hmm.
you know, they have events every week. They have a sense of community. But, you know, a young adult, and even in this, you know, 21st century international economy, I mean, young adults are moving from city to city, moving from different parts of the city to other parts of the city. You know, there
mm-hmm.
it's difficult to develop a long-term sense of community with other young adults. And it's kind of some of that's just natural. I mean, you know, it is meant to be a temporary phase where eventually you enter into a vocation for most people, you know, becoming a priest or entering into the married life, you know, but at the same time, I think having that sense of communal intimacy to encourage each other and to build each other up in the faith, can bring that into consciousness in a way that we just don't have right now because everything
mm-hmm.
is so secular.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're not going to be reminded of the truths of our faith if, you know, we are not immersed in people who are talking about it
mm-hmm.
and, you know, these visible images, you know, that are around us. And really, a lot of times they're only in the church now.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
not like you can walk down the street and you might see an Easter bunny, but you probably won't hear too much about the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ.
Excellent, excellent point. And that's, I think, why I like talking about liturgy so much on the show. It's because, like, liturgy doesn't just belong to Mass. It's like, how do we live a liturgical life? How do we, throughout the course of our year, really enter into the liturgy in a way that, like, walks with Christ, through the life of Christ each year? And I think, Fionn, to your point, like, we need more of that community celebration and observation of what is taking place liturgically to really bring us together more and encourage us in our faith. Because it's not meant to be lived solo. You know, we're really meant to live in community.
Yeah, absolutely true, because human beings are social animals, right? So So how do you flourish best as a social animal?
Social media.
Wrong.
But wait, isn't that where everybody is all the time?
But yeah, no, that's a good point. So yeah, in response to your question, yeah, I do have a favorite memory from my childhood about Easter. Thanks for asking. Only kidding.
You make a great host.
So when I was about 8, we were getting ready to go to Brazil in the missions, and we lived in an old ramshackle house in downtown Jackson, which was an old feeder town for Detroit. You know, it used to be industrial before everything kind of died in the 80s. But anyway, there's 5 of us. And my oldest sister was about 13 at the time, but the youngest sister was 2. And she was everybody's little darling. You know, we all loved little Robin. And she had big brown eyes, looked like a little Indian. And so my mom got her a beautiful little frilly yellow dress to wear on Easter Sunday.
Oh.
And so she got her in her dress, and the rest of us were running around trying to find things, screaming at each other, trying to get into the bathroom. I'm trying to think. I think we had 1.5 baths for 7 of us. And so it was the usual chaos. And so we finally got about ready, ran downstairs. Where's Robin? Robin's sitting on the kitchen table eating butter with a spoon. Oh, it was great.
How was her dress?
I think her dress was kind of buttery, but I believe it was okay because it was a yellow dress.
Aww.
And so I think it wasn't too obvious. Hmm. She used to come into my grandma's house and granny's house and say, chunk of butter, chunk of butter. She loved to have a little butter.
Little butter ball.
Yeah.
Cute.
So, Gian. You're a psychotherapist. I know that you have some experience with working with people with addictions, so I thought I would like to ask you a few questions about addiction, if you're up for that.
Sure thing.
And I don't know why I'm taking over, Deb. You should ask the questions. Is there anything you'd like to ask about addiction?
Well, Gian, you want to just tell us, like, first, what is addiction? Like, how can we spot addiction? Those are 2 questions, sorry.
Right. So I think let's start with what addiction is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's helpful to think about addiction as a compulsive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So what is a compulsion or a compulsive behavior? It is a thought or a feeling that produces an action, or an action is taken because of the experience of that thought or feeling to basically relieve some kind of distress or suffering.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that compulsive behavior, in this case addiction, you know, that can be gambling, that can be drugs, that can be alcohol, that can be pornography.
Mm-hmm. It can be
social media.
It could be technology, absolutely, yeah.
Or technology, absolutely. But the point is there, it is a coping skill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is used
mm-hmm.
to cope with some kind of discomfort that the person is experiencing. And then through, you know, various factors such as early exposure, such as availability,
mm-hmm.
You know, other things like genetic predispositions.
And I would also say the outcome, like whatever the feeling is associated with that behavior, whether it's like a very, very good feeling, the dopamine, you know,
sure,
like that
sure.
has a, sorry, I'm
adjusting. Yeah, no, it's okay. I mean, there's a reason drugs and alcohol and pornography, which are the ones I'm most familiar with,
mm-hmm.
are, you know, so enticing. You know,
mm-hmm.
they produce an incredible amount of euphoria
mm-hmm.
for the person. You know, I know people who say that, you know, they've tried heroin and their life is never the same. Their life was never the same after that. They were like, this is in fact what I would like to do with my life. This is how awesome
mm-hmm,
it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, it's important to give due reverence and respect
mm-hmm.
for the experiences that people have had. I think it's really easy to throw, especially drug and alcohol addicts, into kind of a stigmatized box and sort of otherize them. But at the same time, you know, I think that no one's life is untouched by addiction. You know, I don't meet anyone who does not at least know somebody who has not had an addiction. Specifically, we'll talk about drugs and alcohol for now, but pornography is becoming increasingly an issue for those who consider it an addiction, which is not everyone. So I think that that's the kind of lens that, you know, addiction as a coping skill.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we know that it is harmful. We know that it hurts the user. We know that it tears lives apart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can overdose. You can start, you know, not taking care of your own, you know, needs in terms of food or shelter or health,
mm-hmm.
Cleanliness, things like that. It can, you know, take over someone's life Huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just people,
as far as reliability and responsibility.
Absolutely. Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. You know, yeah. Yeah. Things like arriving late,
mm-hmm.
not showing up, no call, no show, showing up under
mm-hmm.
the influence.
Yep.
You know, all these things happen so that it really becomes, you know, the centerpiece of a person's life and in
mm-hmm.
a lot of ways becomes their God. So, and at the same time, you know, as Christians, we also know that, you know, using drugs, using pornography, using alcohol to excess is also sinful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of an interesting how to recognize that behavior is sinful, but also at the same time, you know, having an addiction is not necessarily a sin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of things that contribute to a person having an addiction or developing addiction that may not be their fault. And it's going to be somewhat an individual basis, but I think it can be really helpful to understand that most people, if not all people, did not have play an active role in developing that addiction. That addiction was not a part of their plan.
So could you speak more to that when you say not their fault? What would be some of those factors that could predispose someone to be seeking this kind of relief?
So, certainly there's trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So a very high percentage of people who struggle with addiction also have a history of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of comorbidity. Also availability. Availability
mm-hmm.
is huge.
Okay.
You know, for people who grow up in basically an inner city area
mm-hmm.
where drugs are at every corner.
Right.
It is a very, very difficult thing to say no to. You know, you factor that in with a lack of a fatherhood, you know,
mm-hmm.
father's presence in a lot of these neighborhoods.
Protective father's presence.
You get kids who are basically kind of running around in a lot of ways unsupervised
mm-hmm.
with not a lot of direction, not a lot of you know, taking charge fatherhood figures,
mm-hmm.
Except those that are also people who are not that much older than them and you know, running the streets, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so you put that together and, you know, searching for that acceptance, for that, you know, especially I can talk about the masculine kind of leadership, if
mm-hmm.
you will, that is present most prominently for most kids and most families growing up in these areas in gangs and
yeah.
you know, groups that get together to distribute drugs.
Right.
Their
bond is really good drugs.
So that being offered and even pressured and, you know, so available is really, really difficult for somebody who's got a developing brain and possibly a traumatic childhood to say no to.
Mm-hmm.
I think of my spiritual director, very wise and holy man, talking about his experiences with some of these kids. And he's like, they've done more hard things in just dealing with life in their neighborhood by the age of, you know, by the time they're in seventh grade than I've done in my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And that line really, really hit me. You know, like it's not really that easy.
So the pain and suffering.
It's incredibly difficult, actually.
Yeah, the pain and suffering that they're exposed to really creates a vulnerability.
Good word.
A vulnerability in their hearts and in their minds and in their lives that makes them more susceptible to a risk of addiction. And then they have, you're saying the accessibility is right there. It's different. It's accessible in different ways in wealthy suburbs. Because in wealthy suburbs, the money's there to bring it out. And so they're willing to pay for it. But, you know, I find that, you know, working in the suburbs, there's as much as far as alcohol and drug addiction, because there's as much availability because there's money. And
so I wonder if you could express that as a formula.
Say again?
I wonder if you could express that as a formula.
Hmm.
So you come from an intact family with supportive parents, opportunity. You don't have to do anything that's beyond your maturity level. But on the other hand, it's so easily available to you, right?
Well, and the thing is, there aren't, I don't know, there may be more intact families, but just because they're intact doesn't mean they're functional.
Good point.
And I think that's really important to note.
So I was going to ask you another question. Maybe this ties in. How does the whole father thing actually work? Like, I feel that it is true, but why is it that kids growing up with just a mother would be more vulnerable? What's the mechanism for that?
Well, Pete, Gian, and my boss, Dr. Peter Kouponis,
mm-hmm.
likes to say that there are three things that men that are part of being a man. Being a leader, a provider, and a protector. And when dad's not there, mom has to do, there's no leader. Mom's trying to figure out how to provide. She's working, she's trying to do, you know, like just survival. We're talking survival. And then protection-wise, she's limited. She's really mm-hmm. limited as far as what she can do protection-wise.
Right.
And so those are severely lacking. And then if there's not a strong, sometimes an extended family can make up for that lack. You know, if there's an active grandfather or uncles, who can kind of step in and be that fatherly guide.
So what about in an intact but dysfunctional family? What do you think?
What do you think, Jim?
Well, it depends on the nature of the dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly all sorts of things go on behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the way I think about it is, you know, it starts with the marriage. It starts with the
mm-hmm.
relationship between the husband and wife, you know, if it is at this point, what was so-called traditional family, and, you know, is there a level of devotion? Is there a level of warmth? You know, I mean, I don't think we can divorce this from faith either, in terms of, you know, the prioritization of one's relationship with God,
mm-hmm.
and what that looks like in the pursuit of the good, true, and the beautiful. And so starting with that, is really, you know, the first step to a good marriage. And so, you know, it does have to have kind of two, yes, wounded, but, you know, also two, in some sense, complete individuals who are coming together, and have a sense of, you know, do they understand what marriage is? What is their understanding of marriage?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do they see it? And do they see it as something that, you know, is meant to be permanent and is meant to be serving of others, outward looking? And so all of that mindset, I think, goes into, you know, whether there's basically an adequate level of health on each side, you know, for each spouse,
mm-hmm.
just baseline psychological health, and also, you know, commitment to the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, talking about dysfunction, I mean, divorce is dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the way that hurts children is profound.
Mm-hmm.
It's profound. It's somewhat amazing to me how normalized divorce is, actually, considering how we know that it actually affects children. And so, you know, divorce.
Did you say globalized? How globalized it is? How common it is?
Normalized.
Oh, normalized. I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's just one example. I mean, I could go on, but you know, the two parents having a good relationship, you know, two parents being present, you know, there's already dysfunction if that's not the case. If that is the case, you know, there's many, you know, distant fathers out there. There are many abusive fathers out there. There are many women who, you know, who struggle to engage emotionally with their children. And there are many women who struggle to maintain a sense of stability and kind of emotional stability in their household.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things have various different effects on children growing up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. I feel like I could talk about this for like an hour.
You saying those things, so many cases come to mind of people that I've worked with where there's, you know, a dominant and an unstable mother. And the father, instead of kind of being a stabilizing factor for her, just panders to trying to, you know, like doesn't want to
mm-hmm.
kind of rock the boat, so
mm-hmm.
we'll just go with whatever mom does.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's, you know, the domineering father. I was thinking of another one, you know, like extremely domineering father and husband and children who are just nervous wrecks.
Right.
You know, with significant anxiety issues
mm-hmm.
That manifest in all sorts of disorders. So, yeah, there's just so many different ways the dysfunction looks.
So,
even in an intact home.
Right, right.
So
here I am. I have various weaknesses or, you know, problems from my childhood. And so someone offers me booze, right? I get started drinking and I'm okay, but then I drink a little more, and then I find that I can't stop, right? So does there have to be that aspect? You said it's compulsive. Do you have to have tried to quit, or could it possibly be that some people have never actually thought to try, but they are addicted to whatever it is? What do you think?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. You said, are you asking if someone can be addicted to something specifically without having tried it?
Without having tried quitting.
Without having tried to quit. Well, the first question that comes to mind is, by whose standard? You know, are we talking about the people in their life, the people that hopefully love them and care about them,
mm-hmm.
or are we talking about themselves? And I think that kind of the classic line is, you know, I can stop whenever I want. I can stop whenever I want.
Right.
So, you know, that line kind of provokes the thought that person probably hasn't tried.
Mm-hmm.
They probably haven't tried, you know,
Maybe they thought of that, because that statement does actually say that there's maybe a thought of it, but it's dismissed for whatever fear, whatever reason.
Just
pointing that out.
No, I agree. It's obviously on their radar,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, maybe it's because of their own self-awareness, or maybe it's something, you know, a loved one brought to their attention.
Or maybe they can't keep a job, or maybe, you know, there are other external factors that are kind of showing them somewhere that something's not working.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I had a client a few years ago, a girl who was, I think at the time, about 16. You know, sort of middle, late teenage years, and very keen on being fit.
How keen?
Well, quite keen, because she, when she wasn't losing weight fast enough by cutting out the carbs, she fasted, actually, speaking of fasting, and dropped weight off quite quickly, quite radically.
How old was she?
She was about 16, I think, something like that. So, go to the doctor. One doctor, pediatrician, says, you're too thin. You need to start eating again.
Mm.
You need to eat healthy, whatever. Mm. Go to the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist says, nah, you're within the range, so your BMI is okay.
Mm.
Meanwhile, you know, a very, how can I describe it? An exercise regime that is, you know, quite intense.
Mm-hmm.
And then a sort of relapse the other direction. So not like but starting to eat stuff with the family and packing on the pounds again. And I think that was about Christmas time, if I remember right. So Christmas time, she puts on a bunch of weight because she's eating stuff again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
January, she's sick of it. She doesn't like that. So she goes the other way. Now she's fasting 3 days in a row, nothing to eat at all, drinking stuff, but not eating anything.
Hmm.
So what do you think? Is that an addictive behavior, or is that like a really single-minded teenager?
Well, it's definitely not a healthy relationship with self.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely reactive. With the eating
The internal family systems, right? You're always talking about internal family systems. Internal family systems.
Yes, but you didn't present any parts of her, Fred.
Parts? I don't know. What are the parts? I haven't learned the parts. You want me to talk about her mother? Sorry, Deanne. I talked over you. Will you please go again? I keep talking over you, and I'm sorry. Bye. I apologize.
It's okay.
We'll meet you from here on out.
We're making this work. So it does follow the binge fast pattern that is characteristic of a certain type of, you know, profile of addict, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it shares enough underlying mechanisms that it's at least similar. It is food, which again does have enough in common with compulsive behavior, with addiction, to be, I think, at least tangentially related.
Mm-hmm.
But
one can,
you know, I would be hesitant to put them in the same category, just because there are a lot of different effects, and, you know, they're kind of the traditional categories that we have, particularly the drugs and alcohol.
We need food to stay alive. So, you know, like I like to tell clients, we don't need sex to stay alive. I mean, I think we do.
Yeah.
So we don't need sex to stay alive. We don't need drugs, and we don't need alcohol to stay alive. Like at a certain point, the brain tells us it's life or death, but it's, we don't actually need them. You know, we do need food.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it's not the same category.
So she wasn't addicted to eating per se. She was addicted to fasting, if anything. I'm not sure it counts, but that would be my argument. She's
so
not addicted to food.
There could be an addiction there as well, though, and that could be kind of like a guilt or a self punishment.
And I'm thinking of the inner critic. You know, when we talk about IFS, we all have this inner critic that's like telling us of things that we're not doing right or things that we're doing wrong. And it can be very helpful because we do things that are wrong that need to be corrected. But right. They can sometimes go on hyperdrive. And with young women, especially if they're looking at their sense of worth and identity mm-hmm. and getting that from social media, where everybody appears to have the quote unquote perfect body shape. And, you know, that's what defines attractiveness or one's value. And if one doesn't measure up to that, you know, then there can be a lot of different messages the inner critic can you know, use to attack oneself. And then also, it, depending on the family life of this young woman, you know, what kind of messages is she getting? Often girls with eating disorders are getting messages from their mother that are not particularly helpful, even if they're intended to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, mm-hmm. what? Are you going to have that second dessert? Or, you know, like, just something that simple.
Mm-hmm.
That,
and the way,
you know,
and the way, especially a developing mind, can interpret something.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's something off with the
mm-hmm.
mother as well. Absolutely.
Right.
Maybe not. But
mm-hmm.
the way things are interpreted by a developing
yeah.
mind, often benign comments or seemingly benign comments
yes.
can have.
They can get twisted.
I don't want to say catastrophic, but a
yeah.
pretty serious emotional impact.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I have a question from a listener. How do you break the chain? You know, if that's a generational thing, from father to son or mother to daughter, how do you break that?
The chain of addiction particularly?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, there are things like, you know, healing the family tree,
mm-hmm.
You know, doing sort of prayers or deliverance prayers to you know, find freedom from generational demonic activity.
There's even a mass,
which is a factor.
There's a mass particularly for that as well. I've had it said. It's powerful. Yeah.
Cool.
So, you know, there's the spiritual
aspect,
dimension.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then on the human level, I would say, I mean, one person has the power to break that chain.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, getting help. Getting help is a way that you can pursue the healing that you need,
mm-hmm.
and effectively, you know, reverse that wounding and not transmit that to, you know, your children.
So I would say one person, yes, but they can't do it by themselves.
Yeah,
right?
I agree.
You know,
yeah.
So one person
yeah.
can make all the difference.
Yeah.
But the lie behind addiction is that I'm in this by myself, but
mm-hmm.
I can't trust anybody to help me,
mm-hmm.
that I'm not lovable and nobody even wants to help me or thinks I'm desirable. You know, that this addiction is the only way that I'm actually going to find comfort or peace in this life. And
yep.
and so part of that seeking help is recognizing that I can't do this alone.
Isn't that true generally, though, about a lot of problems, or I would even say probably most problems?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dr. Jordan Peterson recently was talking about loneliness and how that's really the epidemic that we're dealing with now. And when you look at the DSM, like, how many of those things really are the result of disconnection and loneliness
mm-hmm.
and broken relationships?
So I have another question for you. Here's I will play the devil's advocate. You talk about addiction being harmful for people. It messes up their jobs, costs them money, it's bad for their health. What else? A waste a bunch of money. But those things could be said are not true of using pornography, right? So how is pornography in
addiction? Oh, no. They can be said for pornography, too.
Okay.
It depends on the severity of the addiction. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are many people, many men, at least that I work with, who are impacted, you know, in terms of their occupation, in terms of using at work, you know,
mm-hmm.
using in public, risking being caught,
mm-hmm.
risking being caught
arrested
by their job, spending
mm-hmm.
spending work time on pornography, staying up late at night, losing sleep. to,
so then you're
to
talking
pornography,
like job
taking,
performance.
Taking time away from their family,
mm-hmm.
you know, to view pornography. And that's just the direct act, not necessarily how it impacts them in terms of, you know, the shame and the guilt and the further isolation and the lack of presence that they have, you know, at their job, family.
So the thing to do, therefore, is to normalize pornography use so people don't feel ashamed about it. Is that what you're saying?
It is, in fact, not what I'm saying. I think that
go on.
There's probably some amount of good that can come from normalizing pornography in that, you know, people may feel like they don't have to hide it. They can talk about it. They can connect with one another. But I think overall it's much more disastrous to normalize it because it simply is not a benign activity. You cannot disconnect it from the whole pornography industry
mm-hmm.
and the amount of abuse
mm-hmm.
and exploitation that occurred
yep.
in the pornography industry. You
mm-hmm.
know, the average lifespan of a porn star is 37 years.
Wow.
Many of them die, you know, from drug overdoses or
abuse,
alcohol.
Disease.
It's really serious.
Botched abortions, too many abortions. Yeah, it's bad.
So there's a lot, you know, there. But even in terms of the person viewing the pornography,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people think, you know, it can add excitement to the bedroom. It can help my performance, things like that. You know, we know of a lot of research that there's actually a connection with erectile dysfunction
mm-hmm.
and pornography
in young
use.
Men, no less. In young men.
So, yeah, it's, you know, the idea that it doesn't actually have negative effects on a person and their life is just
unsubstantiated.
Not, yeah, you can't see evidence for that.
It doesn't have a negative effect on a person's psychology. Like, we know that it has a terrible effect on a person's soul, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it can affect the person's marriage. But what about the psychology of the person? Do you think is there something there, or is it mainly the other stuff?
The first thing I think is that it really warps one's understanding of the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of the classic being the male understanding of the female. Obviously there are, you know, it doesn't have to be that, but, you know, just the sheer objectification,
mm-hmm.
that it encourages, men don't know how to interact with a woman in a way that is respectful, in a way that isn't pushy or demanding of sex,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a way that actually, you know, appreciates and actually even sees and receives a certain even pleasure from the beauty of a woman. So it really takes that away, it really doesn't allow a man to enter into a healthy relationship with a woman.
Right. The word selfishness came to mind. Creates a pathology of selfishness. So that it's not, you know, when we think about love, as JP2 talked about it, love is expressed as gift of self. And with pornography, there is no gift. There's no sacrifice. It's all about what can I get. And so, you know, if that's the motive, like from the outset, it can't go a right direction.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So, pornography is inherently harmful and become a real compulsion. Are you okay for a few minutes more, Gian? Or
yes, he is. He's good till 8.
Okay. Just checking to make sure, because I want to give people a chance to talk to both of you guys, either of you, personally, if that is of interest or of help. So how do they get hold of you if they want to set up an appointment?
So what you can do is you can visit our website, integritycounselingpa.com. You know, there's more information about who we are and what we offer and the therapists on staff here. Our office number also is 610-601-9781. That is 610-601-9781. You can give us a call, 8:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Eastern time, or when our office managers are in the office. And, you know, anyone can call. Anyone can set up a free 15-minute consult that we offer to talk to one of our therapists on staff here. And I know we have six wonderful ones.
So they can reach either one of you guys at that number or on that website.
Yes, Gian and I both work at the same practice.
Awesome. And what was the website again?
It is integritycounselingpa.com. Right.
I think so. My cards are right there on the shelf.
Let's make sure that's right.
Let's make sure that's right.
So as Gian was saying, you can have a free 15-minute consultation if you want to bounce some ideas or just see if it might work for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you or anybody you know might be suffering from an addiction or any sort of problem, and the approach of a Catholic counselor, a true Catholic counselor, is going to be profoundly different. Sometimes you might not be able to tell the difference, but there are important ways in which it is profoundly different from a secular counselor.
Can you tell us a little bit about Barnabas and what you do in Missouri?
St. Barnabas Reconciliation Ministries is the nonprofit that I have set up here in Missouri to promote reconciliation between family members, between denominations, and between all people and God. So in other words, we all know, Catholics know reconciliation as kind of what I think of as a euphemism for confession.
Mm-hmm.
But it is descriptive, right? It is true that confession is when you get right with God.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is the most important thing, is if we can help people get closer to God or to get right with God in a variety of ways that we're working on now.
So how can they get a hold of you, Fred?
They can get a hold of us by calling 573-692-4126. So that phone number is 573-692-4126. And the website will be up soon.
Good.
Maybe. But St. Barnabas co-produces this show, but we are guests, really, of the Four Persons Network.
Right.
Which is something that has been developed by John Benko. And I would like to let you know that there are other really cool shows available to you. Live tomorrow at 7 p.m. is Luke Haskell. I'm doing Catholic apologetics. In other words, the truth of the Catholic faith. Next day, Thursday, make sure and be here at 7 o'clock because the best show of all is coming on.
Sorry for the laugh.
Thank you for that, cynical laugh, Jeff. It's my show, theoretically, technically. It's called Uncounseling, and we take kind of a skeptical view of counseling and psychotherapy in general as a profession and a practice. Then on Friday, we have Dustin Quick, a vlogger and Catholic convert, with his story. And April the 19th, make sure and catch this one. This is the famous Benko See Benko show. You have to watch Benko See Benko, 7 o'clock. All these shows are at 7 o'clock Eastern time on the Four Persons Network.
Gian has to head out, so let's give him a thank you. Thank
Absolutely.
You, man. Really appreciate you joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Gian. It's so great to talk to you, and I look forward to talking to you personally, too, to catch up.
That'd be great. That'd be great, Fred. Thank you guys so much for having me on.
You're very welcome, and I hope you get a lot of calls out of this. Have a good night.
Thank you.
So, thank Deb.
You. Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Is that yours? Yes.
Would you like to
yes,
say a prayer to close off?
I would love to. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Lord, thank you for your life, death, and resurrection. And this very special Easter week, as we focus on the resurrection and the power that it contains in our lives, the power to restore hope, to bring healing, to resurrect hearts that are sore, tired, broken, in pain and suffering. So we thank you that we can enter into these conversations and this work of counseling, confident of your healing and the grace that you provide for that. Thank you for Fred and for John and for all those who make the show possible, and for those who are listening especially, that they would continue to hope, because there is the very best reason to do so. Mary, undoer of knots,
pray for us.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Deb, and I will see you later. Talk to you later.
All right. Blessings. Have a good night, Fred.